Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to tonight's Heretics Hour, coming to you live, as always, on this March 12th, 2012. So this is a 3-12-12 day, if you're into numbers. I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host, and I'm pleased that Tan Staffel will be joining me again after the first break. I just didn't think we completed everything that we really had to say about last week's subject matter, and I asked him to come back tonight, and he finally agreed to do so. No, he wasn't too reluctant. He thought maybe I was ruining my show by having too much of him. I said no, not at all. And I did get a very nice email from one of my listeners in Britain who just thanked me profusely for having Tan Staffel and said that she went to his blog, and she thinks he's got a lot to say, and she's glad she got introduced to him. So I'm sure many people feel that way. So he will be here after I do my reading in the first half hour. But before I start that, I just want to make some comments about daylight savings time, which began yesterday. We lost an hour yesterday by having to move our clocks 1 hour ahead, what they euphemistically call spring forward to make it sound like it's fun. I really hate losing an hour. It's kind of nice to gain it in the fall, but I'd rather not lose it at all. I'm not a fan of daylight savings time. That's why I have to do a little harping about it. I think it's unnatural. It messes with our natural rhythms, and it gets people all confused, particularly if you're dealing with times with people overseas in Europe and other parts of the world who don't have our particular type of time, and then the time gets all confused. So, and also I read today that it's associated, the few days surrounding this spring forward day is associated with a 10% increase in the risk of heart attack. And that shows how much we are really tied in with our natural rhythms, and we shouldn't be messing around with them. It's done because of economics. Somebody's agreeing with me. It's done because of economics. Basically, and I don't know, but it might be good for good economically, but it's not good for us physically, and so it really ought to be looked at seriously. Anyway, another thing I have to tell you now, because I will naturally forget it if I save it to the end of the show. So on this coming Saturday, March 17th, 5 days from now, I will host William Fink's Christogenia Saturday radio program. He's going to be absent. He's rarely absent, but he will be absent on this Saturday, along with Rodney Martin, who will be hosting it with me. So this program begins at 7 p.m., 1 hour earlier than Heretics Hour. That's Central Time. It would be 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And, of course, don't forget, these are daylight times now. I hope that some of you can tune in to that. And, of course, you can also listen to it in the archives, but it's nice to have people listening live because it is a live show. And if you don't know how to get there, you can just Google Christogenia Talk Shoe, and that should take you right to the page about 15 minutes before the program begins. And it'll be, you can just click on and get into it, or you can go to Christogenia.org. And listen to, there's a couple of radio, little radio players there. You can listen to it there if you can't figure out the other or don't want to. All right, so that's next Saturday night. I will have that on my website. So I am going to read from the fire now, so I have enough time to complete what I've got mapped out here. And as I, you know, I realized after last week that I had said in my announcement that I was going to be reading about the cities, some of the French cities that were bombed. And then what I did was I was checking ahead, and I had mapped out another portion further on, and I'm a little worried that this is going to take me forever to get through everything I think I should read in this book. So I thought, well, I'll just start here, and I forgot that I therefore skipped the French city. So today I'm actually going back, and I'm going to start on page 108. I think it was 122 or something I started on last week. I'm going to start on page 108 and cover this very interesting section. And so I'm going to go right to it. The background for this is, of course, the Allies had landed at Normandy, and they hadn't gotten too far. They were in France, and they were trying to get into the Reich, and they were running into a lot of very strong resistance. You know, the German soldiers, as worn out as they had to have been and as at a disadvantage as they were fierce fighters when this landing took place, which never should have been able to take place. But that was some treason going on in the German ranks that messed up the resistance of the Germans to the very beginning of the landing. So they got a beachhead there, and they got a strong position, and then they had to fight them. And this is kind of the background. It says here they were going to break out near Caen. Boy, I forgot to find out how to pronounce that. I think it's Caen. And it's spelled C-A-E-N. That's one of the major French cities that were destroyed. Anyway, I'm going to start here. Before the tanks waiting on the other side of the Orne River started moving on the morning of July 18th, this would be 44, Bomber Command took off with an armada of 2,000 bombers, the likes of which no German city had ever encountered. They aimed to eliminate 5 fortified villages at the breakthrough point and also to scatter 7,000 tons of bombs over an area of 80 square miles. And so the city of Caen went down too. The Church of St. Giles, with its unique mixture of Norman, Romanesque, and Gothic elements, was built starting in 1082. Its construction had continued for over 3 centuries, and now it fell into nothingness. Guarded by the archetypal Norman church towers, St. Pierre lost its spire, which had been regarded the most flawless in the region. A measly stump remained, and the 600-year-old vaulting of the aisle was blasted away as if in a quarry. Nothing remained of the magnificent French Baroque city hall. 2/3 of the buildings were destroyed, and 3,000 bodies scattered throughout the city. Germans taken prisoner were so agonized by what they had seen that they could not be interrogated until 24 hours later. Even by the standards of strategic bombing in the Reich, this was the maximum damage possible below the threshold of a firestorm. No single raid on Berlin achieved such a level of lethality. After the Romanesque vaulting collapsed, Operation Goodwood spent the rest of the afternoon caught in the depths of the German defenses. It was later claimed that this made it all the easier for U.S. troops to break out of Normandy at the edge of Brittany in Operation Cobra. That occurred on July 31st, well, that's a couple weeks after this, near Avranches, and led to the colossal turn toward the northeast that pointed directly to the Rhine. After massive bombardment, the isolated fortifications in the ports of Le Havre, Boulogne, and Calais were taken in September. The bloodshed by residents surpassed even the level of Caen. 6,000 civilians died there, but not as a result of actions by Roosevelt, whom Churchill had not all that long before asked to refrain from what he called the French slaughters. It was Churchill who then proceeded to slaughter far more efficiently than Roosevelt did. Churchill would only have had to express his concern for the people of Boulogne, Le Havre, or Calais to Air Marshal Arthur Tedder, who was in charge of Bomber Command at these 3 cities, as well as Caen. But Montgomery was having trouble taking Antwerp's North Sea access from the Germans, where the Allied forces were hoping to land their supplies. So, in their fear of getting bogged down and lacking supplies, being crushed by the Germans, they abandoned all their humaneness. As Roosevelt had known from the very beginning, that kindness would disappear if it forced the inexperienced Allied troops to confront the Germans without sufficient materiel. And that's a very true description of the kind of fighting that was going on in the Western Front, if people are honest about it. If necessary, Frenchmen would be slaughtered. Port cities were desperately needed, and the bombers had long been accustomed to softening up cities through civilian massacres. 12 months before these events took place, Churchill had watched a film with a weekend guest, Richard Casey, the Australian representative in the war cabinet. The film had been shot by Bomber Command during the Battle of the Ruhr. Now we're back to the Ruhr again, not the Roar. Ruhr, R-U-H-R. It showed the bombardment being carried out, and the lens saw what the pilot, navigator, and bombardier saw in action. Casey noted in his diary that all at once Churchill, quote, sat bolt upright and said to me, "Are we beasts? Are we taking this too far?" I said that we hadn't started it, that it was them or us, unquote. So the Australian representative did not know all the facts, obviously, and he probably believed what he said, had talked himself into it, that they hadn't started it, and that it was a fight between them or the Germans or the English. But actually, Churchill had to know better, that he did start it, and that Hitler actually had no desire to destroy Britain like Churchill wanted to destroy Germany. So the us, in quotes, remained the same, but the them increased continuously. First they were the Germans, then the Italians as well. Now it was also the French, along with Romanians, Hungarians, and Bulgarians. In the winter of 1943-44, the Allies drafted plans to wage air war against Hitler's allies in southeastern Europe, Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria. Sofia was given a rough time between November 1943 and April 1944 by British and American units, according to the method they used in Germany, which was daylight alternation, destruction of the water system, tearing up of residential blocks, and arson. In April, the areas of Sofia around the train station burned for 2 days. Air raid protection was minimal. Sofia lost several thousand residents, as did Bucharest, which was a railroad objective. Railroad objectives were always military targets, and they always stretched out in the city centers. Quote, "Our attack on the marshaling yards at Bucharest was a bloody affair," unquote, wrote General Ira Eaker, temporary head of the 8th Air Force, in a letter of April 17, 1944, to the Pentagon. He goes on, "We killed about 12,000 people. 6,000 of them were refugees on trains in the yards. 6,000 of them were Romanians living about the yards." Can you imagine? They had refugees on the trains, sitting in the yards. Well, they just bombed them. They killed 12,000. They killed all of them, says. Civilians of the Axis powers and civilians in areas occupied by the Axis powers died by the thousands. Turin, Milan, Genoa, Paris, Nantes, Lille, Amsterdam. So that we're talking about Italy, France, and Holland. None of them could hope for any special consideration. At first, it was a military and a transportation target, such as the U-boat shelters in Lorient on the southern coast of Brittany. American bombers were not able to penetrate the concrete encasement, and General Eaker asked the Pentagon for orders. Assistant Secretary of War for Air Robert Lovett responded that the Royal Air Force had abandoned all restrictions against occupied territory, so the U.S. forces should, quote, "wipe out the town as the RAF does," unquote. So, you know, the Americans came on with their airplane fleets, and they said they were going to be more humane than the British were, but eventually they were doing the same thing. They wanted to save their own soldiers. All right, continuing. One place was spared, although many of its inhabitants were the only ones really looking forward to an attack. In the early summer, of 1944, four Jewish prisoners from the Auschwitz extermination camp had managed to escape. Now, this is this phony story. I don't know if I should tell it, but I will. But, you know, Friedrich is accepting it, or at least he's pretending that he does. So he's got it in here. This is the kind of side story that we have. These four Jewish prisoners managed to escape from Auschwitz. They told the Jewish community in Slovakia about the use of gas chambers. The news reached Switzerland, and later, on June 24th, was transmitted to the governments in Washington and London, along with requests to bomb a transportation objective, and notably the railroad lines to Auschwitz. A list with 20 train stations along these tracks was included. Churchill personally read the report on June 27th and wrote to Foreign Minister Anthony Eden, "What can be done? What can be said?" Eden advised what Zionist leaders Chaim Weizmann and Moshe Chertok had told him. It was the same as the news that made its way from Slovakia via Switzerland, bomb another railroad line in Europe. Churchill instructed Eden, "Get anything out of the Air Force you can and invoke me if necessary." Well, the RAF was skeptical of risking the lives of British airmen for no purpose, is what they said. But since it would have required visual bombing, it fell in any case within the responsibility of the U.S. forces, who were in charge of day raids. John J. McCloy in the Pentagon had received four appeals to bomb the railway lines to Auschwitz. As his deputy noted, his answer was to kill this. There never was a raid on this transportation objective, nor were plans for it ever drafted. Well, the background of this is that John J. McCloy was always heavily into intelligence. He was in military intelligence, and he knew. They all knew, the Americans knew, that there was nothing to these reports about Auschwitz and the so-called gas chambers and all these Jews being murdered there and so on. They knew that. So that's why he said to kill this, because he wasn't going to deal with it. He wasn't going to do it. They had more important things to do, they thought, than that, because it was propaganda. All right, I've got 8 minutes left. On July 13, 1944, a week after the landing at Normandy, Hitler started firing the reprisal weapon that had been anticipated for over a year. It was a small, unmanned, guided aircraft that was loaded with 1,830 pounds of explosives that went off upon impact. The launching ramps along France's Channel coast had already been installed in the summer of 1943, but they were continually attacked by Bomber Command. The same happened with the testing grounds, the most secret site in the Reich, Peenemünde, on the Baltic Sea island of Usedom. The V-1 flying bomb was launched from an inclined catapult track. A piston hurled it into its trajectory using chemically produced steam pressure. Once it reached a velocity of 200 miles per hour, its pulse jet engine accelerated it to twice that speed, propelling it to London in 22 minutes. The initial launch was slow. Of 63 positions, 9 missiles took off, 4 of which reached London. One of them killed 6 civilians. It was not possible to hit a precision target with this weapon. With a dispersion of 10 miles, it struck randomly. It was used in the morning and afternoon hours to kill as many people as possible in the bustle of rush hour. What had not occurred in London during the winter of 1940, or in Germany for 3.5 years, was to be accomplished with this weapon. That is, panic and collapse. See, none of this bombing had brought about panic and collapse yet. While the other side resorted to the old bloody method of ground invasion after hundreds of thousands of dead civilians and airmen had brought no results, German reprisal, without any strategic or tactical prospects, caused the deaths of 15,000. Now, that's considered, of course, a low number. I mean, you feel it's terrible to say that, but it was in comparison to what else was going on. On the morning of July 6th, Churchill reported a lamentable 2,752 casualties to the House of Commons. 1 million Londoners, mostly women and children, were evacuated that summer. In September, 25,000 buildings were destroyed. Of the 8,839 V-1s that targeted London, 27% struck residential areas, killing 5,475 people. The government was aware that the Germans possessed another weapon besides the flying bomb. R.V. Jones warned the War Cabinet that these rockets might weigh over 11 tons and that 1,000 of them might already exist, flying at an unprecedented velocity of almost 4,000 miles per hour. They could reach London in 3 to 4 minutes. Jones had caught the basic gist of Hitler's V-2 rocket. It did not differ considerably from the V-1 in terms of range, warhead, and accuracy, but it weighed 14 tons and was about 20 times faster. From the mobile launching ramps at Hoek van Holland, it could, in fact, reach England in 5 minutes. There was no defense. A bomber might not get through because a fighter could pass it by and inflict damage. The rocket was invulnerable because even a jet fighter could reach only 1/6 of its velocity. Let's see, I can finish this or I can go on to the other part. I guess I'll finish this. The imperfection of this weapon was at first its weak destructive force. 3,000 V-2 rockets would have been necessary to transport to London a tonnage comparable to what had been used to create the Hamburg firestorm. That is, more than they had. So they, the Germans with their rockets couldn't even do what the British had done in Hamburg. But in the 7 months of deployment of this weapon, only 1,359 were fired at London. Its cyclopean weight caused it to drill several yards down into the ground, and it ignited such that the shock wave spread out both upward and down into the earth. Based on the damage generated day after day in Germany, this damage stayed within the range of what was considered militarily insignificant. The weapon of reprisal was from the outset incapable of just that. V-1s and V-2s killed 8,938 people in Britain and injured 22,500. The rocket struck silently and invisibly since it flew almost a mile per second, and it had a profound existential effect. There was no alarm, no duck and cover, no prayer when, on November 25th, a V-2 hit a Woolworths store in the London suburb of Deptford, claiming the lives of 160 midday shoppers. Excuse me. Excuse me. Including passengers on a bus who, having been killed by the blast, remained sitting lifeless and dust-covered in their seats. Churchill and many British, especially bomber pilots, harbored a particular hatred for the rocket. It was considered a treacherous, cowardly weapon, since the means of annihilation had been stripped of every trace of battle. There was no pilot sitting on board risking his life. Except that, recall that once they had destroyed the German Luftwaffe, they were flying all over Germany in mass hordes, dropping bombs and strafing civilians with no resistance. So that was there couldn't be anything more cowardly than that. The pilots were not taking any, were not risking their lives any longer. To continue, when Churchill was informed of the qualities of the V-2 by Jones on July 18th, he told the War Cabinet that he would seek reprisal for the weapon of reprisal. He said that he was prepared, after consultation with the United States and the USSR, to threaten the enemy with large-scale gas attacks in retaliation, should such a course appear profitable. High-ranking RAF officers and even Portal himself advised moderation. "Those damn silly rockets," as Harris called them, caused less damage than a single bomber command attack on a German city. Churchill would not be swayed, and to be on the safe side, he already had some squadrons trained in the use of gas. Air Marshal Tedder, commander of the air segment of the invasion, raised objections, saying there would be no advantage to initiating a gas war shortly before Allied forces invaded German territory. All right, I then am going to move quite a few pages ahead, up to page 131, and I won't get too much of this done, but I might get some. This is, now we're back talking about what happened to some German cities. Xanten and Wesel faced each other where the Rhine takes a bend at the mouth of the Lippe River. The latter was a trade center and had been shipping goods by river from the Munster region since the Middle Ages. The former was a Roman veterans encampment and later became the site of the sojourn of the Nibelungen's son, Siegfried. Although unconfirmed, the legend had a more powerful effect on Germans than the legend of St. Victor, the martyr, did, namesake of the most magnificent cathedral between Cologne and Aachen. Under the sign of the cathedral and the sound of its bells, Xanten, I don't know if that's how it's pronounced, but X-A-N-T-E-N, X-A-N-T-E-N, led a wistful existence in the sweet light of the Rhine Valley before it became the headquarters of the 1st Parachute Army. In the raids of February 10, 12, and 21, this would be 1945 now, really at the end, right before, during the time of Dresden, actually, 85% of Xanten was destroyed, like Siegfried and Victor in one, by the U.S. 8th Air Force, and in part the artillery of the tormented Canadians. The Canadians were having a very hard time. Of the 42 vaults in the five-nave basilica-type church, 27 had collapsed. Both the Carthusian monastery and the convent of St. Agnes tumbled, as well as two patrician villas that had withstood the changing time along the Rhine since the late Gothic period. But now they got in the way of Montgomery's river crossing. Well, too bad I can't finish this interesting part. Maybe I'll pick it up next week right there and then go on and advance ahead a bit. So thanks for listening to this again, and I'll be back in a few minutes with my guest Hansel.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Palestinian militant group has announced its truce with Israel is over. It comes after 14 Palestinians were killed in a series of Israeli airstrikes with retaliatory rockets launched in response from Gaza. Tel Aviv claims those targeted were terrorists, but a total of 30 civilians have reportedly been hurt on both sides. RT's Paulus Lea is in Jerusalem and now joins us live here on the program. Hi, Paulus. So what has provoked this sudden exchange?
Well, as you say, more than a dozen Palestinians have been killed and dozens more have been injured, many of them children, in this latest Israeli airstrikes over the Gaza Strip. Now, the most high-profiled Palestinian to be killed by the Israelis is the leader of the Popular Resistance Committee, Zuha al-Kaisi, who publicly went on record and acknowledged his ties to the kidnapping of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who was held for more than 5 years in captivity in Gaza and released late last year. The Israelis say that in addition to this, they have evidence that he was involved in the planning, the funding, and the directing of a deadly cross-border raid from the Sinai Peninsula into Israel last August. Now, the Israelis have also been targeting a number of empty training camps across the Gaza Strip. And this afternoon, Saturday, Israeli officials are holding an emergency meeting to deal with the situation. Cairo has criticized Tel Aviv for breaking a tacit ceasefire that has been in place between Israel and Gaza. And the Palestinian Authority says that it is Israel to blame for creating a negative environment that will only see an escalation of violence. In the last 24 hours, there have also been some 80 rockets and mortars that have been fired by Palestinian militants from Gaza into southern Israel, and a number of Israelis have been injured. One of them is in a serious condition. Now, in addition to this physical manifestation of violence on the ground, we have been investigating a different type of warfare, a much more subtle type of warfare taking place here in Israel, and that is over the question of the right to education of Israeli children. But as we've been finding out, that right is somewhat watered down when it comes to Arab children. Take a look. The lessons of life come early to the Abu Labdeh children. Hours before the rest of the country wakes up, these young Arabs are preparing for their long trek to school. It's a 12-kilometer walk there and back. Tiring, difficult, and more than a little hair-raising.
It takes the children about 2 hours to get to school, the older ones helping the younger ones with their bags. But the road is dangerous, and just a few days ago, one of the children narrowly missed being knocked over by a car.
The children have to walk along dirt paths and cross many busy streets. Part of the journey is on a bus, but after they get off, there's still an hour more of walking. They're late every day and exhausted even before the first lesson starts. The youngest is...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, listeners. This is the Heretics Hour, coming to you live with Carolyn Yeager. That's me, and my website, I'll remind you, is CarolynYeager.com or .net. I'd like to bring on Tan Staffel right now, who is blogmaster, if that's the right term, at ageoftreason.blogspot.com. Hello, Tan.
Hi, Carolyn. Gesundheit. I heard you sneeze there.
Just a few earlier. Ago. Yeah.
I hope you're okay.
I've got the door open. It's warm here today, and I've got my door open, a couple windows, and so something must be coming in from outdoors. It's the first time this year I've had that going on while I'm doing my program.
It's been a mild winter all around.
Yes, yes. Well, we have a lot to talk about. You know, we had so much last week, and we covered a lot of good ground about excuses white advocates make for not talking about the Jews. We had a lot to say about the Jews and what should be said about the Jews. And then we got cut off at the end, as so often happens, because I don't watch the time well enough. And I don't like to interrupt someone who's talking, and so I wait, and then, you know, pretty soon the music just cuts us right off, and I don't like that, and I felt like we were so much more we could say about this, and we needed to have another go at it. So we're going to talk tonight. I changed the title after we discussed a few things between ourselves to Jewish Influence in White Communities in America. And I'll just say right off that by white communities, I don't mean just residential communities. I mean any kind of white organizations or groups fits into that. Like VOR is a white community. And and other organizations and other groups are white. We could name quite a few of them, I'm sure. But you can do that if you want to. So we're gonna announce. I've got some problems and solutions. We wanted to talk about freedom of association, how that might work, how we could use that, and also just areas in which Jews have entered in, are being welcomed, and I think are a very bad influence, and we should, I'm going to get into that, why we shouldn't go that route. So what would you like to start out with?
Well, I'd say it's a very big topic, because it means, or it applies to Jews at large in general, the bulk of whom consider themselves outsiders and who operate freely in our liberal society as if there are equals, or, you know, in fact, they are treated as superiors. But it also, I think specifically, the kind of people that we're going to focus on tonight are these people who try to insinuate themselves into our organizations, the organizations that we try to form to defend our interests, to discuss what our interests are. And there's always Jews trying to get into those in order to pursue what's best for the Jews, in order to make sure that they're playing every side of every game, to make sure the Jews come out on top.
Excuse me. Yes, and you know, the thing that bothers me is that most of the white people welcome them and feel that they are, think of them as one of us because they are convinced that they don't. I think that we're not critical enough. I have been totally uncritical of many Jewish people who've been in, come in, who are considered, you know, oh, this is a great Jew here. Look at, he's on our side. And then on further study, you find the most amazing things that these people say. And you really show me a lot of this that, I've learned some from you just in the last few weeks. The way they talk about white people is a real giveaway. You find that they're very, very critical of white people, but they put it in terms of, well, we're losing, white people are not doing what they should do, they're, you know, because they're all a bunch of losers is what it comes down to.
Yeah, they're stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Jews are, as a people, one of their personality traits is storytelling and their narratives. I wrote about the Jewish narrative, but it's really a collective of narratives. It's a tendency to create narratives. And you see it not only in the mainstream narratives, but also in these alternate narratives that get created. There's Jews all over them trying to create heterodox views that attract people, that divert attention away from the Jewish role in the mainstream, the ownership of the media and the domination in politics and all of the nasty things that are being done by Jews. They create these elaborate theories about Illuminati and Masons, and not to say that there's nothing there. That's part of the trick, is they come up with plausible, semi-factual explanations for things. But if you pay close attention, you can see that they're omitting an important part, the Jewish role in it. So that's a common thing. I see that in lots and lots of places.
Well, I'm going to jump right in here and mention someone, and it's going to offend some people. It's going to be a lot of people are unhappy about this, but I really, here comes my feelings. I hate to sound like I'm attacking people who shouldn't be attacked, but I'm going to mention Paul Gottfried because he is sort of the perfect example of someone who is one of us. He's certainly considered one of us far more than I am in many amongst many large groups of people and white advocates and so on. Sort of in the academic area because he's an academic, but he was just on last week with Robert Stark, and he said a lot of things. I listened to that again. In fact, I was just listening before the program. I was quite surprised at seeing these very kind of things that you have pointed out. And first, I ask: is he a full Jew? I mean, I can't find any information about him. But I think so. He is Jewish. And I also always thought he was a German Jew because he's got a German name, but he's a Hungarian Jew. And he's very critical of Germans and Germany. And he also, he said right out on Robert's show, I'm not anti-Israeli. He's not anti-Israel, which is something new to me because I just assumed somebody who was paleoconservative or on the right would be anti-Israel, but he is not. And so what is his position on Israel? And the other thing
for Israel, he supports Israel.
That's amazing, isn't it? And then he continually on that program in kind of a subtle way, maybe. I mean, people maybe they think that he's just being objective, but he was really bashing Germany and Austria and praising Hungary, Poland, and the Czech Republic. I know the grounds on which he's doing it, but Germany has been under U.S. occupation and Austria basically too. They have been unable to overcome their terrible guilt that's thrown on them all the time for World War II. Another thing about Gottfried is that he goes along with that. He is he believes in the Holocaust. He believes in the bad, how bad the National Socialists were. And he goes along with all of that, and yet then he, at the same time, blames Germany and Austria and the Germans for not being able to stand up for themselves and being such milquetoast people and taking on all this guilt.
Yes.
There's something wrong with this.
Yes,
yeah.
And he blames the German people collectively. He doesn't say the German leadership is screwed up or go into why, explaining why they do what they do. It's just the Germans are these horrible people that are killing themselves, that are committing suicide. And this is one of the markers of this. It's the suicide meme. He does that while deliberately overlooking the Holocaust narrative, the whole reason that the Germans are self-abnegating and so belittling of themselves and step aside so much for minorities is this Jewish narrative, the Jewish version of history, the Jewish guilt tripping that says that white people have been responsible for horrible things and they need to feel guilty about that and they need to make up for it by now opening their borders to everybody and treating everybody as equals, which in reality means treating them as even better than their own citizens. And that's what we get. That's why the German leadership behaves like it behaves. And if it didn't behave that way, it would be punished economically and politically for violating those principles that are supposedly springing from within the German soul itself. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and the German people know that. They know they can't change. They know they can't vote in a more, and say, even a slightly nationalistic politicians and get away with it. They know they can't do that. They've tried it in Austria. The Austrians have tried it, and they've been punished. So another thing I'll just real quick throw in here that he said on that program was that they were talking about the difference between the it was brought up that David Duke was arrested in the Czech Republic because he was praising the Czechs as not going along with any this kind of stuff that the Germans do. And Robert Stark did say, was it David Duke, or maybe he couldn't think of who it was that was arrested in the Czech Republic. And then Paul Gottfried said, I don't know about that, but I know that David Irving was arrested in Austria, and a terrible thing, and he started in on the Austrians. And the Germans again. So see that this stuff is subtle. It's very subtle unless you're kind of looking for it. It just passes you by.
What I noticed in listening to the interview is factually, he really didn't say anything that was counterfactual. He didn't say anything wrong. He wasn't lying mm-hmm. about anything. It was more a matter of attitude. He described the situation in Europe, and then his attitude was, well, this is the Europeans' fault. What he said about the Islamic the Muslims flooding into Europe is, I quoted it because I think it's so interesting. I find the entire anti-Islamic stuff a total bore. If you don't want them in Europe, don't let them in. That's the answer. Now, of course, that overlooks the fact that it's Jewish organizations are running the show there as far as calling the Muslims or regarding the Muslims as the new Jews. And if anybody tries to close the borders to Muslims or anybody else, that it's the Jews screaming so loudly. And it's the people with a Jewish mindset of we've got to protect minorities, especially the Jews, from this kind of Nazism. That's why Muslims are in Europe to begin with, and that's why they can't just deport them or stop them from coming. They were talking about Geert Wilders, who is actually very pro-Jewish, pro-Israeli, pro every other line item on the liberal agenda, the homosexuality and feminism and everything. The only thing he stands against is Islam, and they call him a Nazi anyway. There are a few Jews who support him, but it's only because he is so supportive of all the rest of the liberal agenda and because he's so supportive of Jews. He just wants to take care of Muslims, and the Jews that support that are afraid of Muslim anti-Semitism. That's the only reason that they oppose Muslims immigrating. They don't want the same criticisms that are applied to Muslims by Europeans to be applied to the Jews. They think that's just a sign of insanity. It's very frustrating. And Gottfried goes along with that, as far as I can tell.
Okay. I think my Skype connection is not the greatest because you're sounding all funny. But whenever I hear that, I think it's the other person, but it turns out it's me. So I hope I hope I sound all right.
You sound clear enough.
Okay. On the Occidental Observer, there was an article by Edmund Connolly in which he wrote about Paul Gottfried on Viktor Orban and Hungarian nationalism. And I went through that, and I also saw some very strange things. Now, for one thing, not a whole lot, but I will just say here that Gottfried was talking about, Orban is a nationalist leader who's been elected to as the top man in Hungary now. I really support him. I'm really happy. I hope he can hang on there. But what Gottfried did was he admitted in this, the whole article is about the fact that Gottfried was so great because he admitted that the people who were against Orban in Hungary were these older, predominantly Jewish population whose families had been persecuted and sometimes murdered during the Nazi occupation and sometimes by Hitler's Hungarian collaborators. So he's bringing up again the bad Nazis and how these Jews they don't do such good things, but they were persecuted and murdered during the Nazi occupation by Hitler. And he also believes in the persecution of the Jews throughout history. You know, he goes along with all of that. And then he says, but then he admitted that these Jews, these Hungarian Jews, included family members of his who were heavily involved in two brutal communist dictatorships in Hungary, the first under Béla Kun and the other under Matyas Rákosi. But then he says that these people, they're considered called atheists, but they're ethnically Jewish. And he says that this has inevitably generated anti-Semitism against Jews. And because he also believes in anti-Semitism. And then he talks about some Israeli historians that he recommends, one of which is Richard Pipes, who discuss this problem in their books, and that Wikipedia ignores it. But anyway, and then this writer on says, hats off to Professor Gottfried. And the only thing I can figure on that is that because he admitted this about his Jewish background and his Jewish family members who were heavily involved in brutal communist dictatorships in Hungary. You know,
hats off. Now get out is what I would say. We don't need allies like that. What I was struck by in Stark's interview with him is he has a very dim view of the place in Europe, in Eastern Europe, where nationalism seems to have the strongest sense. He's not sympathetic to, I'm not Eastern European at all, but I'm sympathetic to Eastern Europeans having a say over their own, the goings on in their own country, just as a matter of principle. And also as a European, I feel that camaraderie and good wishes toward them. Likewise for the countries that I actually do have, and especially for the Western European countries that I actually do have roots in. So I don't, I really get a negative feeling from him.
Yes, because, you know, if he is so into the right wing, the white rights or whatever, and he's, I don't know if he's into white rights. I don't know if he says about whites. He talks about, he's paleo conservative. He's, he says all the right things about a lot of that stuff, but when it comes down to it, he really has never accepted that there's that the Nazis weren't guilty as charged, and that the Holocaust happened pretty much as said.
Yeah, let's get to the bottom line. I don't think that he would support or does support the right of whites to exclude Jews. Period.
Well, he wouldn't, would he?
No, I think that his purpose in participating in the alternative right, and not only the website, but in the larger movement. In general, is to secure the place of Jews amongst us, that so that we never get the idea that we should just exclude Jews as a group. This is true of other Jews, and what they do when they get worm their way into our movements is they make sure that they're sniffing out anti-Semitism, and they're they spend most of their time, or a good deal of their time and energy, attacking anti-Semitism and the anti-Semites rather than promoting white interests. Even if they saw white as including, as all-inclusive of Jews, they don't really, because, I mean, Gottfried talks about Jews as a separate people and sees them as a separate people. I think what sucks in people like Edmund Connolly to say nice things about him is they have these thoughts of, well, this is one of the good Jews. There are so many bad Jews doing so many bad things to my people. Well, here's one that I can find that, because I know there's so much pressure out there not to be labeled a Jew hater, I can call this guy a good Jew, and he's my buddy, and that makes me a good person then, too, because I found a Jew that I can look up to and respect. And I just don't get it. I get why they do it, but I don't get why they can't face the fact that they're only doing it to prove themselves. It's like the Tea Partiers who talk about how much they love Martin Luther King to prove that they're not racist. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's still this same thing. We cannot collectivize things. We're still into this individual people as individuals far too much. Because if you start looking at this in this way, you find every one of these good Jews is doing the same thing. Well, they're doing the same thing. They're one thing they're all doing is upholding the Holocaust and National Socialism and the evil of National Socialism and Hitler. I don't say that just because I'm a writer about that and a fan of that. But I mean, they do that. And the purpose of that is that is the biggest protection against any kind of criticism that they have.
Yeah, it's not even just treating these people as individuals, regardless of what group they belong to, their Jewish identity. I think he's specifically held up because he's a Jew, because he's one of the good ones.
Yes, yes.
And because he's saying these nasty things about Jews. If anybody else said things like that, would he be published by Alternative Right? Or would he be held up as such an icon? I don't think so.
Well, that's right. So Jews are held, these particular special Jews are held to a lower standard. They don't have to reach the standard. Well, I think it's a lower standard. You know, they can have all kinds things that aren't quite kosher about them, but that's the wrong word. but they're accepted because as Jews, it's understood that they're going to have some loyalty to their Jewishness or to Judaism. Now, this is dangerous because we really can't afford that in our movement. And this brings us down now to the point, to the question, should people like Paul Gottfried be acceptable? And should they be brought on VOR? I can't speak about anything else. I'm a part of VOR, so I feel like I can say something, and I'm probably going too far for some people's idea, but some people's comfort. But should he be considered one of us, or should we be far more exclusive? Because in what way is having people like him around helpful to us, except it doesn't save us from being called anti-Semitic and so on?
No, it doesn't.
No.
And
what does it do?
Personally, I would say it's fine to let him have his say, but let people like myself or other people who want to criticize him have our say, too, say what we want to say about him.
If he comes on, I think it should be made very clear that he's Jewish and that he stands up for a lot of Jewish values. And
yeah, and the criticisms he makes of Jews are very weak criticisms.
They're like
Jews are coming on a little too strong with their Holocaust story, and they're maybe calling people anti-Semites that they shouldn't call anti-Semites. You know, I Googled Paul Gottfried anti-Semitism, and one of the top hits was an article he wrote for Tacky magazine about Kevin MacDonald, and it was all about anti-Semitism, and it was a critique of Kevin MacDonald that in the end he concluded, unlike MacDonald, I see no compelling reason to blame this lunacy, meaning the suicide meme that I was talking about, this lunacy exclusively on or even predominantly on the 2% of the population which is Jewish, without noticing that the majority group, including those who describe themselves as quote-unquote conservatives, have lost their cotton-picking minds. In other words, it's all our fault. It's white people's fault, not that 2% of the small minority of Jews. How much influence could they have? They're just a small number. He's so disingenuous about that. And as I say, the purpose of his piece is to attack MacDonald. He's joining in an attack that liberal Jews in the mainstream are making on MacDonald. And he chimes in from the alternative right. Here's the house Jew, and he's going to make comments now disparaging MacDonald or tearing MacDonald down gently, but not undermining MacDonald, making him sound like he's crazy too, that he blames everything on the Jews. And it's a misrepresentation of MacDonald, and with people like that on our side, we're going to lose. This is part of our problem. We refuse to recognize that there's a competition going on here, that there's different teams, and that people with loyalty to the other team don't belong on our team. They're not members of our team.
Yeah, yeah. And what are some others? Now, this is not somebody who's even remotely a white nationalist or even a paleoconservative. He's a liberal. But Gordon Duff is another one, though, who is constantly attacking whites and making out that everything that happens is the fault of whites. But what are some others? Do you have some other names that come to mind that we sort of take as part of our group?
There's a big one, and maybe we could talk more about him in the next after the break. But Lawrence Oster, and it was actually through Lawrence Oster that I found out about Paul Gottfried. I had never heard about Paul Gottfried 4 or 5 years ago. but it was through Lawrence Oster's interactions with him that I found out about him. And they're really two peas in a pod. They're both Jews. They both have insinuated themselves into the conservative right. They're both kind of heretical, say critical things about the Jews. And they both ultimately, when you follow their logic and follow their arguments, they ultimately excuse the Jews and blame liberalism and especially white liberals, Christians, for being suicidal. That's what their explanation is, what their narrative is.
Okay, we'll do that when we come back. And I'm also going to talk about Holocaust revisionism and Jews in that, and I've got one in particular, Samuel Crowell, that I've been investigating. So we'll get into that when we come back. So, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Daniel Renches. President Barack Obama has described the weekend killing of 16 Afghan civilians by a U.S. soldier as heartbreaking and tragic. The dead included 9 children, and the Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has described the killings as unforgivable. U.S. forces in Afghanistan are being warned to remain on guard against possible reprisals after Sunday's shooting in Kandahar. From Washington, Simon Marks reports.
Once again, the Obama administration is on the defensive in Afghanistan, maintaining the shooting was carried out by a single rogue soldier. The acting U.S. ambassador in Kabul, James Cunningham, delivered this message to local people.
We deplore any attack by a member of the U.S. Armed Forces against innocent civilians and denounce all violence against civilians.
But there is intense anger in Afghanistan over the killings. U.S. diplomats have been warned about possible reprisals, so have members of the military serving there. All of this coming just 1 month after U.S. troops inflamed opinions by burning copies of the Quran. It further undermines President Obama's policies there. Simon Marks, Washington.
Republican presidential candidates and other critics are suggesting it's time for a rethink on Afghan policy, also citing days of rioting following the burning of Qurans at a U.S. airbase. But President Obama has told a local TV network that the U.S. needs to get out in a responsible way, adding that there will be no rush for the exits. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton confirmed there is an investigation underway into how the incident occurred.
A full investigation is underway. A suspect is in custody, and we will hold anyone found responsible fully accountable.
The opposition Syrian National Council is calling on Arab and Western governments to carry out a military intervention in the country. They're calling for the establishment of a no-fly zone across the country to protect those opposing the government of President Bashar al-Assad and to enable humanitarian relief. Foreign ministers are arguing about the degree of international intervention at the United Nations. The UN's humanitarian chief, Valerie Amos, has just arrived back from the country.
I was horrified by the destruction I saw. No building was untouched, and there was clear evidence of the use of heavy artillery and tanks. Baba Amma was almost deserted, a few people in tears as they tried to salvage a few possessions.
Olympics officials in London are coming under mounting pressure to speak out against Saudi Arabia's apparent refusal to send female athletes to the 2012 Games. Campaign group Human Rights Watch has already called for the Saudis to be banned from the Olympics altogether after publishing a report accusing them of systematic discrimination. But the London 2012 Organising Committee is now under fire for its alleged silence over the issue. From bureaus worldwide, this is FM.
return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and we're in the second hour of the Heretics Hour. I'm Carolyn Yeager. My guest is Tan Staffel of ageoftreason.blogspot.com. And I'm going to give out the call-in number now, and it is 1-855-477-2283. If you have something that will really contribute to what we're talking about, okay, or a question, or if you disagree, but it has to be brief, but you are welcome to call. And we're here to take your call. All right, Tan, we were going to start in with, you were going to talk about Lawrence Oster as another example. Okay.
Yeah, let me give a brief synopsis of my experiences with him. I was first drawn to him through the counter-jihad that I was involved with, the thoughts of criticizing Muslims and Islam and reacting to the worldwide jihad. Anyway, I discovered this fellow, and he seemed so much more comprehensive because he was dealing with immigration and domestic issues, as well as all this stuff that was happening overseas, the war in Iraq and everything. And he sounded good to me because he talked about things like liberalism and all the symptoms of liberalism. He described everything in terms of liberalism, it seemed, and he described it as being this principle of non-discrimination. And he had some radical solutions he was proposing too, like separationism. Which is the idea that we should just deport the Muslims and we should separate ourselves from blacks as well, because they are bad for us. And us meaning, you know, Western civilization, Western society. And this all sounded very good to me. It was closer to nationalism than the counter-jihad was. And so I took a step in his direction and started paying attention to what he was saying. And the fact that he was a Jew eventually came out, or that he was a Jew that had converted to Christianity. And he said some pretty unfriendly things about Jews, or critical things about Jews, like Gottfried does. Now, at this point, I didn't know about Paul Gottfried. All I knew about was Lawrence Oster. And I didn't criticize Jews, even. I was not aware that the counter-jihad was essentially a Jewish movement that was all about directing white people's nationalistic instincts into serving Israel's interests and defending Israel and defending Jews. I came to see that later. And the thing about Oster that finally drove me to break my friendship towards the Jews, or my friendly view of the Jews, was he described something he calls the Oster's first law of majority-minority relations in a liberal society. It's a long phrase, but he keeps going back to it. And what the way he describes this law is as if it comes from nowhere. It's just out of liberalism, which comes from nowhere, and that it describes everything that's going on. It's sort of his theory of everything about society's ills, and especially white society's ills, Western society. And it's this idea that the worse a minority group, any minority group, behaves, the better they must be treated in this liberal society. And my first thought when I heard this was, what about the Jews? I mean, he himself talks about the Jews in other contexts. In the context of his first law, he never mentions the Jews, or didn't until I came along. And I said, what about the Jews? And he lost it. I mean, he turned from a perfectly intellectual, a very rational guy who would talk about and split hairs about everything. He just turned into a gibbering idiot immediately and started calling me names. That was his reaction. And he made up all sorts of excuses why his law didn't apply to the minority called the Jews, and because they're not violent, and because they don't really whatever. I mean, I can't even remember all the stupid excuses he came up with, but they were all stupid. They were obviously stupid. And in the end, the thing he kept going back to was that I'm just a bad person and an anti-Semite. You know,
what? Why?
We've got a caller on the line, and he's not waiting. Oh no, Robert Stark. We're not gonna take a call from Robert right now. Sorry, Robert, but
I'm right here.
Robert, it's we don't want to talk any more about your show. We're going on to something else now. Okay, we just don't have that much time. Thank you. Go ahead, Tan.
Yeah, well, I found it curious that Auster, for instance, talks about that our problem is non-discrimination, that white people just don't discriminate. And in particular, he meant we don't discriminate against blacks or we don't discriminate against Muslims like we should and are justified to because of all their bad behaviors. But then the minute somebody like me comes along and says, hey, we should discriminate these Jews and discriminate for the same reasons that you say we should discriminate against blacks and Muslims, he goes berserk. He thinks that that's a sign of insanity. And so I, at that point, I realized this is all just a bunch of bull. He's just making up this narrative, this explanation about liberalism being everything, in order to actually excuse the Jews, in order to transfer blame away. And it was an article of his that he wrote having to do with some argument that he was picking with Gottfried, where he actually, I titled it Two Liberal Jews, Same
Yes.
Dissembling or something.
Yeah, I read that.
Because they seemed that they were pretty much on the same page. They were both motivated by what's best for the Jews in the back of their mind. They never really come out right out and state that, but you can see that that explains their behavior. And even the argument that they have is usually about, well, whose ideas are more harmful to the Jews? You know, that guy's a bad guy because what he's saying is bad for the Jews. You know, Gottfried, for instance, his position on Auster is too ready to call people anti-Semites, and that's a bad thing because it sort of weakens the charge, you know, when it really is necessary to use. Auster yeah. is critical of Gottfried because he says things that are critical of Jews that are different than what Auster says and his criticisms of Jews. And in particular, this article that I wrote about the two liberal Jews dissembling is they were criticizing or they were exploring what liberalism really means. And they revealed that, lo and behold, both of them recognize that liberalism is not this universal thing that everyone who's a liberal believes the same exact things. They recognized what I think is a very important point, which is white liberals, white people, are doing something that's harming themselves, and they're doing something silly that could conceivably be called suicide, if not for the fact that they also acknowledge that the Jews who are identified as liberals are perfectly okay. They're doing what is in the best interests of the Jews. Then they don't put two and two together. They don't say, well, it can't. White people aren't suiciding themselves because they're doing what they're doing in deference to this other group of people, the Jews, who are actively participating and interacting with these white liberals and will punish them if the white liberals don't do what they're doing, like people like us that are, you know, ostracized or marginalized or called nasty names and by people who are supposedly on our side, you know, supposed good Jews, the conservative Jews like Auster and Gottfried. So it was when I realized that I moved beyond Auster, and I'm not really all that interested in paying much attention to what Auster has to say anymore because of that, because I realize he's just spinning things.
Yeah, well, so you're saying that white liberals are suiciding themselves, or they're willing to take on this guilt. And you know, one thing that has to be said here, guilt should never be harbored. Guilt should never be entertained in any. I don't care what we do or what's done. It shouldn't result in feelings of guilt that continue on that we keep having to atone for. If you do something wrong, you say, "Well, this was wrong. This didn't work as it should have. I shouldn't have done this." And then you try to make change your ways, but you don't sit around and carry around guilt. Guilt is the most destructive. It's not an emotion. It's some kind of an idea. It's the most destructive idea that there is, I think, and that's why it's being thrown onto white people.
Yeah,
by Jews.
It's caused by an outside influence. It's guilt.
That's
the
right.
Guilt is caused by guilt tripping. It's by people saying, hey, this is something that you should feel guilty about. And it's something I refer to as the litany of white sins. And it's recited over and over again. Every day you can hear it a dozen times if you pay attention to the news. You know, the litany of white sins, the big ones are you enslaved the blacks, you genocided the Indians and stole their land, you gassed the Jews. And then occasionally you hear some others like you knew.
Oh, there's all the colonialism, everything that we ever did somehow it hurt these people.
Yes.
And yet they're all flooding in to try to be in our countries. But the thing is that...
When he was on Stark, the image popped into my mind where Gottfried was sort of sneering at the at these guilty Germans and just how vile they are for the way they're behaving. You know, throughout their entire lives, from the moment they're born through their adulthood, just one person after another guilt-tripping them about how bad they should feel about what their forefathers did and how they have to pay back for that. And then along comes Gottfried and says, and you should feel bad about yourself for suiciding yourself. It's like the last item on the litany of sins is, you know, you gassed the Jews, you enslaved the blacks, you stole the land from the Indians and genocided them, and then you killed yourself.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that blacks and any other Indians or mestizos or anybody else would not be the problem, particularly the blacks wouldn't be, if it wasn't the Jews telling them what to do. Well, the Jews started all that. The blacks were not really even guilt-tripping the whites. Maybe some were. I might have my history. It might be, you know, deficient in my history. But really, none of these people would even be the problem if it wasn't for the Jews supporting
template.
Them and telling them what to do and getting behind and running their organizations until they catch on and they all know how to do it. And we really need to wise up to this. We need to get very tough and hard when it comes to feeling guilty. And we should, even if there is some things that we've done wrong, we should put that off until later, until we strengthen ourselves, you know, and just not allow that in and attack it wherever it comes up and attack the person that's trying to make us feel guilty.
Yeah.
You know, these Jewish people that we've just been mentioning, if they're bringing this stuff up, we shouldn't go along with it. And that's one of the big problems we have. We're so nice. You know, we say, oh yeah, okay. And we let them go on and on about the bad things we've done, which is what Gottfried has within his, paleoconservative statements. He's full of this kind of stuff that's attacking whites.
And he's not against it. He's not against guilt tripping white people. He just thinks that the Jews who are in power, in the mainstream, are overdoing it and that's bad for the Jews because they're overplaying their hand. But he would still go along with the guilt tripping. He still thinks that a certain amount of guilt tripping is necessary or good or defendable or, you know, in the best interests of the Jews. In fact, that's why he doesn't want it to be overplayed. He wants to reserve it and keep it for the situations that he thinks it's useful for.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's exactly what's going on in Holocaust revisionism, too. And here we have a situation where, once again, because Jews, one thing we know, they understand that they want to take control both sides of the issue, both sides of every issue. And they seem to have not found a way to get into Holocaust revisionism until recently. You know, they've been pretty much against it. And there are some in the past that seemed like they were sincere in trying to get at the truth. But now there's a bunch of people coming along into revisionism that are what you call the moderate. See, just like Gottfried is a moderate in his field, they want to have a revisionism which is more easygoing and which moderates what revisionism is to a certain extent. And there are some of them on CODO Forum, but I don't think I have time to really talk about that right now. So I'll just go to this Samuel Crowell, who turns out, I never knew this. He's the author of The Gas Chamber of Sherlock Holmes, which is a critique, so to speak, of there being gas chambers. He's a Jew. He's 100% Jew. And he got interested in, he was a believer. He read all about it. This was, you know, quite a number of years ago. And then he, wrote some articles, and then he wrote this book, and it kind of got forgotten about it. Now it's been resurrected, and actually CODO has resurrected it, has helped to resurrect it. And in it, he goes after the gas chambers And he goes after the number. Well, he's not interested in the number. And the other thing he goes after is that there was a plan that the Germans wanted to kill every Jew in Europe. He says, he doesn't go along with that. But everything else, he goes along with. He goes along with the guilt of the National Socialists and the terrible persecution of the Jews. That's the main thing, that, the Jews were really persecuted. Here's some things he has said. Revisionism his revisionism is focused on diminishing the stature, both moral and political, of the Nazi destruction of the Jews. He's not interested in diminishing the stature of the Holocaust, he says. He does not want to diminish that. He says, but he says it's not in the Jewish interest to support the criminalization of historical interpretations that appear at first glance to be inimical to Jewish identity. So he encourages his Jewish brethren, he calls them his Jewish brethren, to be more tolerant of Holocaust revisionism, absent any explicit malicious accusations. So again, he's saying, well, we're going to have, I'm really a good guy here, and I'm a revisionist. But I don't want to do anything to diminish the stature of the horribleness of what the Nazis did. And I'm doing is in the Jewish interest. What's not in the Jewish interest, I'm not interested in. And I mean, he admits all this, and then he says, of course, he probably doesn't want to be attacked.
So why does he aim his commentary at Jews, exclusively at Jews, or is he aiming it at everybody?
No, he's just aiming it at everybody.
See, he should aim this kind of criticism at the Jews. He should print it in Jewish publications for Jews to consume. If he's talking about the best interests of the Jews, that's who he should be talking to.
Right? Well, that's right. See, and all of these foolish people who consider themselves revisionists, even the ones who just, talk about it on forums and so on, they don't see through this. They will go along with it and say, well, here's it. Here's a Jewish revisionist. See what good work they're doing. And there's a thread there now on that forum for Jewish revisionists. And I was trying to say that that Jews should not be in the revisionist movement. Then the thread got destroyed for supposedly some reason. And now they're trying to rebuild it again. But I'm not on it now. And so other people are just praising the Jews, looking for Jewish revisionists. Finding all kinds of them. And it's just very strange. I just see this same thing happening, because every time you find a Jewish revisionist, they still have this loyalty to the Jews. And there's so many things he says here. He's really concerned with free speech, and thinks that you shouldn't, revisionists shouldn't be persecuted. Well, that's easy to say, and most people think that. But then he'll say, like, about false witnesses. Here's the thing. I'm going to end with this. He's saying, speaking of why false witnesses would lie, he said, well, it's hard to speculate about why somebody would say something that just isn't true. Now, one of the biggest problems about the Holocaust is these lying witnesses who tell all these lies, and the whole thing is based on that. So anyway, he says, well, it's hard to know why they would do that. There may be selfish motives, vengeful motives, or simply survival motives. True. There may be cases of sincere false memory. Huh? There may be cases of memory inspired by noble motives of testifying on behalf of the dead or one's family. But how can that be noble if you're lying because you want to testify on behalf of what you think is dead Jews or your family? Would that be noble of me if I lied about that? When I knew what the truth was? But they make this acceptable for Jews because they have these they're just trying to protect their families or whatever.
To the fact that Jews have a tendency to exaggerate their own suffering.
Exactly. Now then he says, I generally soft pedal these issues. I am trying to justify revisionist doubt and reconcile what I consider to be a dangerous opposition between two sides. Well, that's very revealing, because he wants to soft pedal this because it is a dangerous opposition between two sides. Because if we are able to show eventually, well, we have shown, but it has to be accepted that the Jews are lying, that most of these Holocaust survivors are lying. And if you get into it, I mean, people who really get into it know how much the incredible lying that goes on. It's going to, you know, these people should be in trouble. But he says, I am not interested in calling anyone out. Well, sure, because he doesn't want to call out these Jews. He wants to say, well, it's just, you know, they had these reasons, they were wrong, so we're just going to let it go. And that's exactly what he is saying and what many say that are in revisionism now. Well, it was a mistake. You know, they believed these things, but it was a mass hysteria, or this and that and the other thing. We'll just let it go. Well, what about all those Germans, dead Germans, and all those Germans that were hung and that were killed and that were tried on these people's testimony? And what about all the damage they did there and still going on? You know, I'm a little passionate about this, but this is still going on, and these people are supposed to get off the hook. See, this is what gets me angry in revisionism, and when I see more of this coming in, it upsets me. So there's just another area where we let Jews into our detriment.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this fellow Crowell, but it sounds like from your description of what he's doing that he's doing the typical Jewish behavior. He's trying to set the tone. He's trying to set limits about what can be discussed and what shouldn't be discussed and what's not necessary to discuss. He's trying to set himself up as an arbiter.
Yes. Okay. So let's see. I got that in. So now, you know, what I've got listed here is problems and solutions. What we can do, because what I'm saying, and I think you're agreeing with me and you've got your own way of saying it, but what I'm saying is that we really can't afford to allow Jews into our communities because they are really not loyal to whites, as we've pretty well pointed out in this program and last week's program. They're still loyal to Jews. And so now here we have we're also talking about how we can even have white communities, because you know, even if it's groups, that groups are attacked. But if you have an actual white community where people are living and they want to keep out non-whites, then you have a real problem with the government and so on. And so we were just making some points, and that is that that when we talk about being Euro Americans or European, Euro this and Euro that, Euro Canadians, Euro, that it's too broad, it's too big of an, and you can't really bring that all together, because in Europe, there are Germans and there are British and there are French and so on, and that's how they think about their nationalism. But here in the United States, we don't have that. We are mixed Europeans. Many of us are mixed within ourselves, of various, you know, European branches and so on, nationalities. So we should call ourselves white Americans. We kind of both agreed that that was a good term. You've been doing that for a while, and I'm coming along with that. We are, the best we can be is white Americans, and build an American white community, and not worry about Europe and everybody else around the world, and even South Africa and whatever. They have to do their own thing. Well, we can be supportive, you know, and all that. But, and so this is the way to build a movement in the United States. And this is what we share. We share that we're all white and we're all Americans, whether even if you have bad feelings about America like I do. But and so our problems as white Americans is American Jews, not Israeli Jews, not this kind of Jew, or you know, what Europeans are doing, but we need to focus on American Jews, and they are a huge problem, and they are our problem, and keep the focus on what Jews have done to America and not to the rest of the world. I think, you know, I'm all about narrowing down our focus so we can be more effective, and that's my point about VOR, that I'm going to say this too. I think, you know, my opinion, it's only my opinion, is that VOR should narrow its focus to serving white interests, and be very careful about having non-whites on unless there's a real reason for it, because they are putting out their point of view, which is not always our point of view, and it's not. I don't think we should be putting out a different point of view, because we don't have. You know, it's a small network, and I think it would be more successful if its identity was more more focused, more carefully drawn, that it's white identity. Well, what do you say about that, Tan?
Well, I agree very much. I as I said in the last show, that the us and them is very important. It can't be overestimated just how important it is, and that we should discuss it and argue about it and argue about who we are and who we should be talking about and who we are speaking in the interests of. When I use the phrase white, it's sometimes misinterpreted, I think, by European nationalists as being ignorant or thinking that all Europeans are like Americans. I hear that.
Well, yeah, you're going to be cut off. So we will start right there when we get back. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Anger has flared up in Spain once again as thousands flooded the streets to protest against tough government cuts and recently passed new labor laws. Spanish unions staged mass rallies in 60 cities, and they say the labor reform designed to revitalize the economy will actually undermine workers and cut their rights. The new laws were cleared by Parliament last week and will make firing employees easier and less costly. Spain's jobless rate is the highest in the Eurozone, with almost half of its young population unemployed. However, while the government struggles to stay in the single currency, there's a town that's already going back to the good old days.
We're all feeling a bit euro-fatigued at the moment, so it's no surprise that in some places, currency nostalgia is setting in. Although Spain joined the euro more than a decade ago, if you thought you'd seen the last of the old Spanish peseta, you were wrong.
With the country in such a tough economic situation, some towns, such as the Villamayor de Santiago, have been encouraging their customers to reuse their old pesetas as a unique way of generating business.
Unlike other euro countries, Spain has no expiry date for exchanging its old pesetas. In fact, it's estimated that there are more than €1 billion worth of unexchanged pesetas still in the country. So some towns have run schemes to once again accept them, giving new life to the old currency.
We saw that some other towns in Spain had run this scheme and it worked very well there. So we thought, why not try it here? It's been great for the economy of the town.
What's it like owning a business in the current economic climate?
It can be very tough and very boring. I spend a lot of evenings making my own flies for fly fishing. It keeps me entertained.
Being creative certainly worked for this town, netting them more than €1 million. It's around €6,000.
It's not just towns and villages that are contributing to Spain's alternative economy. Here in the heart of the capital, we've come to a store that's found a way to avoid using cash altogether.
Open Sesame is a goods exchange store that works on a point system. Diana tells us that you bring in goods, get points for those goods, and you can then purchase other things in the store. And, best of all, no cash needed.
I think it's a nice idea. I think that it's interesting to essentially be able to barter, like bring something that you no longer need and get something that you do.
I actually really like secondhand clothes. Me and my husband both lost our jobs recently. I was an occupational therapist. He was in construction, so now obviously the cheaper the better.
Whilst these solutions are perhaps a temporary reprieve to the ongoing crisis, they are proving that even in dire economic times, businesses can find ways to flourish and at least make for a few.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm here with Tan Staffel of Age of Treason blog, .blogspot.com. Now, Tan, you were in the middle of saying something when the break came on.
Yeah,
and I should give the phone number again, or excuse me, the call-in number, 1-855-477-2283. Okay.
All right, so what I was saying is that even though I think about Europeans as white and similar to white Americans in that respect, I don't expect that white Europeans will all just get together and hug and say kumbaya and open their borders to each other. I'm perfectly sympathetic with Germany being for the Germans and England for the English and so on, and don't want them to merge. And I also agree with your sentiment that we have to take care of our own backyard here. And in fact, if we care about Europe and the best interests of Europe and white people around the world, we want to think globally and act locally and take care of the issue here. And it's American media and finance and political power that is harming whites all around the world. And that American power is largely Judaized. It's either Jews or people acting on the best interests of the Jews. Rupert Murdoch is one person who comes to mind. Is whether he's a Jew or not, he acts like one, and he defends Jewish interests. So, you know, we need to deal with that issue right here in America. And
well, if so many Americans have taken on Jewish interests, they've taken on a Judaized identity. They don't really realize the average people what they've done, but they've done it. And then the elites probably know that's where the money is. And they're pro-white organizations or organizations that are really serious about the continuation of the white race here in America as Americans. We need to be very observant and very tough in our approach, and therefore we need to go. We need to point out that what the Jews are doing, what they've done, the terrible damage they've done to this country and to all of us, and continuing. One of the biggest ones is the way they have just robbed this country and all the taxpayers, and the taxpayers are paying. Well, just for a thing about Jewish thing, this, you know, probably getting into small things here, but just the way the State Department has that special envoy to fight anti-Semitism all around the world, and that woman now has the job, and we pay for this. Why should the American government and the American taxpayer be paying for such a thing? Why should we have such an organization?
Yep,
it's only for the Jews. It's because the Jews want it.
And I don't think that's a small thing. It might be a relatively small item in the budget, but it's not really about how much money is spent on it. It's about the fact that the Jews are put on this pedestal. Nobody else gets a special envoy like that. Nobody else gets that sort of special treatment. And it's not just for policing anti-Semitism in the United States or the interests of Jews within the United States. It's a global thing. They're sniffing out, and that was one of the things that came out of WikiLeaks, is so many of these diplomatic memos going back and forth between Washington and the various embassies and ambassadors has to do with defending Jews. Jews have grievances all around the world, have trouble with the people there, and whether they're United States citizens or not, they get special treatment from U.S. ambassadors.
Okay, and we've got a caller back, but right before we take that call, let me just say that to finish off this little part we're doing, what can we do about the American Jewish problem? That's my question number 6 of my little list here. And my answer, no Jew can be trusted. That's where to start. I mean, we need to understand that Jews cannot be trusted. And if we don't understand that, because their tribal instincts are too deep, and so they're loyal. We see this with all these Jews we've mentioned. They remain loyal to their group, and they're not going to be loyal to us, and so we cannot trust them, and therefore if we have them on programs, they should be, it should be, it should, we should just have a much more critical attitude toward them. Okay, yes. Robert Stark is called back in again because we invited him since now we've got a little time. And let's take his call. Hello, Robert.
Hello, I just wanted to call in. I noticed since you obviously brought up my interview with Paul Gottfried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we did, didn't we? We did.
I think you make a lot of good points. I don't blame you for being very, very skeptical of the Jews, certainly. But I think if you listen to the interview himself, I think Paul Gottfried, I think he was very hard on the. He talked about the Holocaust industry, and they talked about the neocons being a Jewish movement. I mean, on the Israel issue is a separate issue. I think he does have a concern for Israel, but he doesn't. But I think he wants them to be able to fend for themselves. But for the most part, I think he had a lot of good stuff to say. But you made some points about Paul Gottfried, and if you want to, feel free to ask me any questions about the interview.
Well, you go ahead, Tan.
Well, yeah, first I would praise you, Robert. I thought it was a good interview. It was interesting. I listened to it, and most of what I had to say about Gottfried had to do with what I heard in that interview. I think as far as him being hard on anybody, I don't think he was hard. Acknowledging the facts of reality about the neocons being a Jewish movement motivated mainly to serve the interests of Israel and the Jews in general is just a fact of reality. I mean, it's like talking about the Jewish dominance of media or politics in general in this country. It's not limited to the neocons. In fact, Gottfried maybe makes too much of a point of blaming it all on the neocons. And
exactly.
A lot of what he said about the neocons, I could think of saying about him or people like him. One point that you made I thought was good was when you called him on a seeming contradiction there, where he talked about Christian Zionists in America being useful idiots. And then he turned around a few minutes later and was talking about how they're treated like royalty when they go to Israel. And there was a difference between Jews in America, how they view them, versus Jews in Israel and how they view them. But it's really just a game. It's more, the first thing was really more like the truth. They're useful idiots. And even the Jews in Israel think of them as useful idiots, too. Another good point you brought up that I wasn't aware of was about Norman Finkelstein and his book. And Carolyn, you and I should talk more about Norman Finkelstein, but because he's big in Holocaust revisionism.
Yeah, you know, let me just throw in here, and then I'll let you two go on again. Criticizing the Holocaust industry is old hat now, and Norman Finkelstein, and it's Finkelstein, I think for sure. I don't know why everybody calls him Finkelstein, but it's Finkelstein. He did a good job with that, but he's another one who believes in the Holocaust, and probably, I know, Robert, you're not sure about it. So I understand that because you haven't studied it. But what they're doing is they're saying we're the ones who are doing all the good work about these things, and we Jews, but we're only going so far with it, and that's what they do.
Only going so far, yeah. And that's the point about Finkelstein, is Robert said that in his book, in the last chapter of his
Stein.
Book, he talked about Finkelstein, yeah, that he thought that the Indians, what Americans did to the Indians and the blacks, there ought to be more emphasis on that. And
there you
so
go.
What he's saying is, yeah. Maybe this is his position. The Holocaust is a little bit overextended and a little bit overemphasized, and it's making the Jews look bad because it's, you know, distorted. And so maybe they should scale back that. And by the way, scale up the other items on the litany of sins. Talk about the Indians and the blacks more. So this is not a friend of ours. This is not an ally. This is somebody who's just concerned about what's best for the Jews.
Very good. Very well said, Tan. What do you say to that, Robert?
Yeah, I think you make a lot of good points on Finkelstein. I don't know what. I think Finkelstein is basically follows kind of a leftist ideology that stuff like nationality and race should not matter. Is he looking out for – the question is Finkelstein looking out for Jewish interests? I don't really think he is because he's given – I mean, he's basically become a pariah in the Jewish community.
Yeah, well,
I would say that the ideology – I would say he's influenced – by Jewish cultural Marxists, I'll say that. but maybe he downplays some stuff a little bit because he's worried about a big backlash. But I don't think he has strong loyalty to Jews. I mean, he's become a total pariah. He's even banned in Israel.
That's not by his choice. He thinks of himself probably as a hero, and I know Gottfried, if he didn't use that word, he certainly talked about him as if he was a hero. And so it's, yeah, the Jewish community as a whole has ostracized him and thrown him under the bus, as they like to say, one of their favorite expressions, because he's challenged the Jewish narrative. He's acknowledged a reality that's bad for the Jews. You know, they're overplaying their hand. And, yeah, they don't like him. And the penalty for that is ostracization. They're throwing him out. So he should attack, if he really wants to do something useful, he should attack Jewish nationalism. And not just Zionism, but Jewish nationalism, diasporism, and all of it. You know, if he thinks that racism is bad, well, then attack the Jews for being such a close-knit and ethnically loyal group.
Yeah, I think you make a point, but I also think we should stop using the euphemisms. All Zionism meant was the movement to transport, to encourage the settlement of Palestine. But I think that's a silly word. I know David Duke likes the word Jewish supremacism. I think that's a better terminology than Zionism. But he just still says Zionism a lot.
Yeah,
but
I'm coming to see
Gottfried,
it.
I mean, I think Gottfried is, I think he does care about, I think he's cares about the well-being of the Jews. I think that's obvious.
Right. I don't think he cares about the well-being of the white people. I don't think he likes whites.
Exactly.
He's not white. Look at him. He's not white.
Listen to what he says. He's very dismissive and disgusted by whites. He doesn't like whites.
Mm-hmm. Robert, we have another caller. And so you've stirred something up here. Would you mind letting have you finished? Can we go on to the other?
I'll just add my opinion briefly.
Okay.
I don't necessarily agree. I think Paul Gottfried, I think, may genuinely care about the preservation of European cultures. I mean, if he was just in for it for himself, his own well-being, and for the Jewish interests, why not just be a neocon?
Well, how hard is it, Robert, to be a for European culture? You know, how hard Western
well,
culture?
He's,
all the Jews, no, let me say, all the Jews make a big deal, these kind of Jews, about how they are Western cultural, very cultured people and educated, well-read. They're a part of Western culture and they support it. Big deal. They're not helping the rest of us Well, let's see. The other thing I wanted to say.
Let me add one thing. We actually did address that in the show, and he said how the neocons, the neocons, mostly Jewish, are fraudulently say they're for Western civilization. He admitted that. He said by Western civilization, they mean stuff like mass democracy or consumerism. So he acknowledges that.
These Jews, they want to own Western civilization. They want to own Western culture. They did not create Western culture, but if you listen to them, every writer that they mention is Jewish or has some ties to Jewish. Okay, not every, but an awful lot of them. They want to take it over and take credit for it and make it theirs. We're going to have to go and let's see what Hanning has to say. Thanks a lot, Robert. I'm glad we let you on. Hi, Hadding. Are you there yet? He has to get dropped in, I guess. Well, these arguments that Robert is making, as much as he's very sincere and knows what he's talking about, in that extent, we shouldn't be falling for these kind of arguments. These are the very kind of things that we're falling for.
Well, I know.
Hi, Hadding. Go ahead. Well, go ahead. Go ahead, Tan.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that Gottfried, I'm sure, is similar to Oster in the sense that they defend Western civilization because its Jews have been so benefited so wonderfully from living in the West.
Yeah,
that's their main reason for wanting to defend it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, are you there, Hanning?
Yes.
Okay, what did you have to say?
Well, the main thing that caught my attention in the Gottfried interview was what he said about Germany, because I have a friend in Bavaria with whom I speak on almost a daily basis, And according to him, things have been changing very rapidly in Germany so far as their attitudes toward their national identity. You know, as the U.S. power wanes, they're really getting more and more back to being their old selves.
Well, that's good news.
Yes, it is. That's, yeah. Well, I hear different things. I just heard from a contact of mine a few days ago, and I haven't answered him. He was very depressed about how, and I've never heard him talk like this before because he's very positive usually, but, well, he's very active anyway. But saying that it's so terrible that members of his own family, you know, when members of your own family hate you and won't talk to you, and if you try to say anything to them, they say, I don't want to hear about that. Don't talk to me about that. You know, and he was depressed about it.
You see, that's him talking about his personal situation. My friend, he was talking about things like a statement that some industrialist made at a conference of other industrialists where this industrialist used the expression a racially pure German solution to a problem. In other words, not involving foreigners. And the Central Council of Jews expressed shock over this after it happened. But nobody at the conference said anything negative about it. So it's like only the Jews were complaining about it. So things like this are cropping up more and more. You had Thilo Sarrazin talking about how they need to think more about maintaining their national IQ level against immigrants.
Like with us, you know, if it moves too slowly, it will be too late because of the demographics. And that's why we need to push harder. And sometimes we're a little bit, I don't want to be negative because, but sometimes we're a little too lulled with hearing a few positive examples like that and then think, oh, everything's changing. You know, one thing is that these revisionists on CODO Forum that I'm talking about, who I'm suspicious of because they're so, And they're all British, it seems, and they have you know names. I don't know. You don't know who they really are, but they're all saying, oh, it's just it's crumbling. The Holocaust is crumbling. The whole story is this, that, the other thing. We're winning, and yet when you look at it, the power on the other side is just as strong, and you never know when things will collapse. In a sense, we are winning. More people are being brought over, but you still have tons and millions and billions of people who have never questioned it and believe the whole thing. So
I think old age, if nothing else, is overtaking the Holocaust story. People have to be saying, "My God, this is ancient history."
Yeah, but I would like more for it to. I don't want it to just. Fade into the sunset. I want it to be overturned and
smashed,
right? And I want the guilty to have to answer for their crimes too, because they've done a tremendous lot of damage. The damage they've done to people that didn't deserve it is horrendous. But they had help from American military and all kinds of other people. So
yeah, on the matter of Jewish revisionists. I defer to Professor Forison. He says there really are extremely few Jewish Holocaust revisionists. And most of the Jewish revisionists that people point at are either not really Jews or not really revisionists. You have Dietlieb Federer, who I think was raised as a Jehovah's Witness.
That's
and
right.
You have Finkelstein, who's not in any way really a revisionist. Forison says in Finkelstein's case, I don't know what he means by it really. I don't know the details of it. He says that Finkelstein is upset because he didn't get his cut of the loot or something to that effect.
Well, now you speak German, Hadding, pretty well. Isn't Finkelstein Finkelstein? Why is everybody calling him Finkelstein?
It's just habitual. Well, you know, it's Yiddish really, and I don't know how Yiddish words are pronounced, but it's different from. Some of the pronunciation is different from High German.
Okay, so I'm right. I'm right when I say his name is Finkelstein.
How does Finkelstein pronounce it?
I don't know.
Finkelstein that would be a German pronunciation, but
yes,
you know, it's like Epstein. You know, nobody says Epstein, even though in German that's how it would be pronounced.
Oh, well, that's a good point. Well, Tan, we've got about 8 minutes or less than that, a minute less than that. So let's pull this together, Hadding. I don't want to end up just talking about revisionists because I kind of brought that in because of my recent experiences and because I see the same thing happening. And so what I'm concerned with is that these Jews are infiltrating in all kinds of places where they weren't so much before, and people are not seeing it. That's my main point, and we need to see it. So what do either of you want to say about that?
I think, for one thing, blogs and forums need to be more carefully policed for people that are trying to derail things. That's a complaint that I've had for a while now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you can't, as long as somebody is polite and they can give their opinion, you can't say, well, I think you are, you might be not sincere in what you're saying, so we're going to get rid of you.
I see the same thing, and I used to be a free speech extremist in that I thought that let people say whatever they want to say, but more recently I have been deleting comments where people make either incendiary or comments to derail things. I have less of a problem, I think, with the people coming in and just totally dominating a conversation and taking it off the rails. I don't get as many comments as some other places, but I see Jews doing that in other places, and that is one of their tactics. As far as your general question, Carolyn, I would say that what we need to do is call them out. Call out these people who are promoting Jewish interests from within our own groups, where we should be talking about our white interests, not Jewish interests. And I think that is illustrative enough, that just calling them out on it, just distinguishing Jews from whites seems to drive them crazy. And they go berserk themselves about just what an anti-Semite you are and how horrible you are, what a hater you are, saying all these things that violate other things that they've said before. You know, like in Oster's case, it was that he's against liberalism and he's against, he thinks the idea of non-discrimination is bad. And then the minute you discriminate Jews, I think, for instance, in Germany, if the Germans really do come back and reinstantiate their German identity, that it will be people like Gottfried and Oster will be the first to criticize them. You know, they're calling them suicidal now, but they'll be the first ones to condemn them for anti-Semitism should they decide to close their borders and evict all the Jews and evict all the Muslims and evict all the other foreigners.
Mm-hmm. I have to say this. I promised that we were going to mention freedom of association. We never did get to it.
Well, that's the solution, I think, is okay. We're on that point. Is that's how we get from where we are now to where we want to be. Is if we had freedom of association, people could live amongst who they want to live amongst. But we don't have that. In today's America, we have forced integration. The government actually will come into a community that's mostly white just because people have voted with their feet, and it will say, hey, you are racist. You need more diversity. Mm-hmm. And what more diversity means, it's a code word for less white. And they are not happy. They don't think it's 100% diverse until there's 0% white people.
You know, I thought that Freedom Association was going to be in the Bill of Rights, but it really isn't. It's freedom of assembly. And that is in the First Amendment. But there are some court cases that I wrote down, which I won't go into. But, you know, there's nothing really strong to go by. Most of these freedom of association court cases were won by dissidents, minority groups and so on. Yeah. Although the Boy Scouts of America won against having to admit a gay member. So that was good. But, that's all you can bring up, though. So it's not a very strong right that we have here. And as you say, no, as you say, they don't really allow it. It's not really allowed. And this is a problem that we have.
In fact, the opposite went on the books, you know, with civil rights when they wrote that into law and what it's become since. It's the opposite of freedom of association. You're not allowed to associate with who you want to. You have to serve whoever walks into your store. You have to employ whoever applies for a job. Even if you do, on all appearances, they look at it empirically. And if you've got a place of employment and it's too many white people, then they will sue you.
Yeah. So things are not, you know, it's not easy. And so that's why we have to be very careful who we allow into our discussions and who we give time to. Now, gentlemen, our time is up, and I want to thank you, Tan, very much for coming back again tonight.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it has been a great pleasure tonight. We've had a very good show. And I want to thank you, Hattie, for joining us and for your contribution. And we're going, the music is going to come very soon, 10 seconds. I'm being told. Isn't that nice? I need to be told. So we thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And I will be back next week with something different.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.